I am here, the first interview of 2011 with Paula Bohmer, who is most recently the author of Baby. Paula, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you.
I wanted to first of all start with, with the title story. You have this extraordinary moment where a mother wishes to smash her baby against a brick wall. I'm wondering to what extent you pre-think a situation where you're writing about an uncomfortable situation. Is there an inherent risk to some degree in exploring what might be argued as shock value behavior, or how does these things come into your head?
Well, I had a lot of fun writing that story. I think it's one of the funnier ones. That one is basically pure satire. But there's also, like any, I think, good satire, there's elements of truth and real emotion as well. And actually, a lot of women have written about that exact same feeling in nonfiction books. So that was a little bit of the inspiration. Anne Lamott wrote a book called Operating Instructions, and Louise Erdrich wrote a book called The Blue Jays Dance, A Birth Year, and both of them discuss nonfiction, you know, wanting to like smack the baby or hit the baby, and then, you know, having this real incredible moment of frustration. So it had been done before. But I think in the context of the Baby, the title story, the character is so, you know, it's not this lovely nonfiction book with nuances of other emotion. You know, it's pretty, she's not a very likable person. And so I think that giving her those thoughts make it even harder to take.
Yeah.
Because she's not very sympathetic.
Well, there's certainly a stigma upon any kind of thought of neglect. I mean, Ellen Waldman got into trouble with Bad Mother for indicating something along those, like, I would rather be with my husband than my children, right, that kind of thing.
Well, you know, when I was, you know, this is 15 years ago, I have teenagers now, but still, I remember the pressure to be, there's this strange idea that mother means good.
Yeah.
And actually, mother just means you had a kid, you know, and everybody has, not everybody, but lots of people have kids, and it doesn't make you automatically a good person.
The Manson family.
Yeah. Right. Well, it's just, I was actually hoping that, I was like in the trenches of the playgrounds, and I was hoping like, this is a time for people to be loving and supportive to each other, because it's an incredibly difficult time. You're not sleeping. Your life has changed, you know, so on and so forth. You have this incredible responsibility that gets sick a lot and cries, you know. And yet in the playgrounds, it was more like high school all over again. You know, it was just like really hard to find people who wanted to be understanding instead of pick at your weaknesses. And that might be a New York thing. I said in my Publishers Weekly interview, I'm from South Bend, Indiana, and it's a different childhood.
Yeah.
And it's a different way of, you know, New York, it's like New Yorkers, sometimes they just can't turn it off. It's always got to be like some competition, and even like motherhood. And I just think, like I said, I think that's a corruption of what is a beautiful, you know, a difficult but beautiful experience.
But not just motherhood. What constitutes abuse? Does a thought constitute abuse?
Yeah.
Does a homicidal consideration of your born child constitute abuse?
Well, you know, that's funny because Giancarlo Di Trapano asked me something similar to that. That's a Catholic idea, you know, that our thoughts are, we are our thoughts. And I don't think we are our thoughts. All sorts of things go through your head, and we are our behavior. Mm-hmm. So having a bad thought can make you feel terribly guilty, but I don't think it makes you a bad person, no.
Yeah.
Why I think that character is bad isn't because she has a tough moment with her baby, but is because she's so shallow.
Yeah.
You know, she's kind of it's a satirical, you know, Upper East Side mom, even though I think she moved to Tribeca, but, you know, just everything's about, like, one-upping someone else.
Yes.
Even having kids, like, becomes a part of it, you know.
Well, so. I'm glad that you mentioned whether a thought translates into an action, because there is something very interesting you do in these stories. I want to point to two of them. In The Mother of His Children, the second paragraph could almost be the first paragraph the way that it's written when it describes Ted Stanton. But then you have the first paragraph, which is very consciousness heavy. And that really is the story, and that is the motivation for it. Similarly, you do something similar with A Galloping Infection, where the first paragraph reads as if it's the beginning of a noir story, with the wife's body dragged out of the two-bedroom house, and then you have the second paragraph that begins with a sentence, he no longer would have to disappoint her. My question is how you arrived at this bifurcation between plot and consciousness. It's almost as if you're suggesting with these stories that narrative can't always capture these more unpleasant and seamy sides of consciousness.
When you say, you mean narrative can't capture it, be so, you mean the plot?
The plot,
yes. The plot. So then, yeah.
Okay,
there is a lot of internal, yeah. I like getting inside the heads of my characters, and it's not the only way to write, but all right, Galloping Infection in particular, the man's in shock because his wife dies, and I think anyone who's experienced, you know, the death of a loved one, even though he also discusses his lack of love for her because, you know, relationships are complicated. But I kind of wanted to capture that shock, and so I think you really need to get inside someone's head because the things that go through your head when someone dies, it's funny. Some of the darker stories, I had a lot of fun writing. Like I actually was like, you know, there's another story about marital rape. She Was Everything to Him, which originally appeared in Fiction, and it's not a funny story. Some of the stories are funny. But this one is not. And yet I was giggling the whole time I was writing it because I knew I was doing something subversive. And it's fun. It's fun to kind of go places. For me, it's fun to go places where I'm not supposed to go. You know, I'm too old and don't want to be a rebellious teenager anymore. So I get to be really kind of, you know, wrong in my work. And it's wonderful fun for me.
Wrong. I mean, I'm wondering if...
Bad. How's that?
Yes. Bad versus wrong. I mean, should it even matter if the reader is laughing in response to one of your stories or whether they're deeply moved by the stories? I mean, you're investigating emotional terrain that is, there is not necessarily the right way to react. It depends on the individual. I mean, do you say that you're worried if someone is laughing at that particular story.
Huh. Well, I guess I wasn't thinking of it like that. I'm thinking that some, like a lot of the press has talked about how dark the book is. And I'll say yes. But there is also real differences between the stories. Some are just kind of emotionally straightforward and sad, I think. You know, these are just my opinions, but you're right. People might be, I'm not so worried about being misunderstood regarding whether some people think certain parts are funny. There's a line in the last story, which I don't think is a very funny story, about eating goulash. And someone just thought that was so hilarious. And I was like, what's so funny about eating goulash? So, you know, whatever. But I do think that it's not just dark. It's funny, which you mentioned. But not everyone gets the humor. And that does, I guess it irks me a little bit if people don't get the humor and they only see the downer. Bits of it. But anyway, what can you do? You can't control your, you know, readers' responses.
Yeah, that's true. But I think you are consciously trying to keep a lot of these really terrible thoughts confined to the characters' heads. I mean, they don't act upon them, not always.
Generally not.
And that tension between what's inside their heads and how they decide to act is, I think, where some of the humor comes from.
Yeah, okay.
To what degree do you keep a character, I suppose, these evil things, so to speak, inside the head? I mean, what generally is the circumstances in which it's going to go from head to action?
Well, I don't know if you're familiar with Patricia Highsmith's short stories or her novels.
Yes,
as well.
Yes. And love her, please.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. I love her, too. And I'm not, obviously.
Also a very unpleasant person, too, for all reports. There was biography of her that came out
last
year. I know,
she had bad political views.
Oh, not just that. She was, like, you know, really mean to people. And
really?
Yeah, yeah. There's like a bio that came out last year that has all this dirt, which...
That's a shame.
Yeah. Well, because who cares?
I don't have to hang out with her.
It's fascinating, you know. Yeah.
Right. No, it is fascinating. It just reminds me of a writer I know who, his work is very compassionate and sweet, and he's like the biggest asshole I've ever met in my life. So, though it can be, but she shows a lot of compassion for her characters, and So if she wasn't a compassionate person in real life, she gets she goes to these, you know, they have these dark feelings and stuff, but then you see the incredible conflict of like, how do they get to acting on, you know, and I think she does that wonderfully. And she's very internal. She's so inside the head of her would-be, you know, soon-to-be criminals. But you really, you see the build-up, you know. I tried to do, I think a galloping infection, I somewhat implicate the husband in his wife's death. He didn't kill her.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of neglect going on. And just remove when a person, and you know, we need each other. People need each other. We need each, humans need to look out for each other. And a lot of my characters don't do that. And I think that's just unfortunately, a problem with human nature. I was talking about the playground scene,
yeah.
Similar thing. And that's something that I think I really explore in this book, is how we fail each other and how sad that is.
But in Galloping Infection, you have almost consequential action to thought to action, which I think is very interesting. You don't always see that. I was talking earlier about the relationship between thought and action and what is narrative and what isn't. And you correctly corrected me in terms of pointing out that really what we were talking about was plot.
Right.
But yet, I think in that story, there really is a sort of plot-like tension between how the loss of the wife affects these actions and causes this terrible sort of spiral of behavior. And so to kind of go back to what I didn't quite get from you in that last question, you know, to what degree does a character step outside his head? I mean, do you throw actions at the character so that you're kind of testing to see if these thoughts will actually escape their head? Or,
well, you know, one of the this book's been around for a while, I'm so happy that it's out, but one of the complaints about, even when I was submitting certain ones to magazines, each
yeah.
one got rejected at least 20 times, you know, but there are a lot of them are just internal and not a lot happens. For instance, The Mother of His Children, the first story, which, you know, people loved, and Open City is a great magazine. I was very happy to have them publish it. But basically, a man leaves his house, he gets on a plane, and then the plane is about to land, which I don't know if you know that story. Is it called A Man on a Plane by Mary Gateskill?
Oh, yeah.
And it's That's, a similar yeah. setup, but you know, he discusses a gang rape, where this guy just discusses something with a person, whereas in my story, it pretty much all happens in his head.
Yes.
So then I tried to balance it with things where there was a lot more action. And in The Shitty Handshake, a lot of things happen. And she's someone who, she thinks something and then does something. Like, she thinks, I want to have an affair, so she has an affair. She thinks, I want to go get drunk, so she gets drunk. So, like, I'm going to go to an AA meeting. So I have that one. She's really moving around, and lots of things happen. So there's a variety. She's probably not a very likable character. You know, the thing about likable is I actually like a lot of these characters. Not all of them. But I find it interesting to try to understand people I don't like. And that's another motivation for my writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't really like social climbing, shallow, you know, people.
Yeah.
But I'm surrounded by them because I live in New York.
Yeah.
And they intrigue me. And so I was trying, and I try to humanize them.
This is explained in part a lot of the pot shots towards the rich in these stories.
Well, this is, a friend of mine read the book, an old friend of mine from Taft. I went to a really snotty boarding school. And which was kind of hard coming from South Bend, Indiana. And he's now like a hippie and lives in Hawaii. And he read my book and he said, I'm so glad I didn't marry one of those air-kissing, so, you know, like fake. It exists. It doesn't only exist. There's obviously wonderful wealthy people who are generous and sweet and kind. But that's not what this book is about now. It's about the darker side of the upper middle class.
Yeah.
And also how class forms people. Money, right? People who handle money in... Jean Rees, I think, handles it really well. I'm trying to think of who else. She's actually one of my main inspirations for the way that she handles discussing class without, you know, just, I don't know, in fiction.
Yeah. Well, I also wanted to ask about the fact that you have a number of these characters are writers. Now, I didn't think
of
myself.
They? One of them, definitely. One of them is that the shitty handshake.
You've got Laura and Baby. You've got...
Oh, right. She's a poet.
Yes, yes. And then, of course, you're having the shitty handshake. Karen says she was a writer for a reason. She loathed groups of people. now, I don't want to subscribe any vocational parallel here. I don't think that at all. But what I thought was that these characters are writers because... this is really the only way you'll actually get these stories on paper. One of this consideration, which now that we are talking about it, seems to be largely subconscious on your part.
Well, Philip Roth is another person whose work, you know, when I talk about these other, you know, Gene Reeser, all I mean to say is I get ideas from them, from reading their work. And he has... you know, Nathan Zuckerman, his whole like alter ego, who's a writer and has, you know, all sorts of crazy things happen to him. And I love his Nathan Zuckerman books, love them, including his kind of fake autobiography, The Facts. So that's probably, you know, I didn't really put, I guess I, in The Shitty Handshake, I knew I wanted that character to be a writer. I think an aspiring poet's a little different.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, no, I didn't really think about that.
She was a writer, as it says.
I guess it is largely me. Yeah, it's a little subconscious and a little influenced by other people who do it and do it well.
Yeah.
And, you know, the novel, I have a novel that I'll be trying to get published, which is, unfortunately, even nastier than this collection, though.
Unfortunately?
So I mean, well, I think it's funny. But anyway, that character is a painter. And a friend of mine, another writer, read it. And like, why do you make her a painter? Why don't you just make her a writer? Like, why do so many writers, you know, pretend that they're, like, not put the character, their main character?
You can't choose a writer, so you choose, like, a painter or a musician.
Exactly.
Something along those lines.
Yeah, and that seems
or
a
filmmaker.
Little... I mean,
yeah.
I stand by that novel, and that's a perfectly fine way to write fiction.
Yeah.
But then there's also the... you know, I guess it's taboo, writers writing about writers, but that's not what these stories, they're about people who happen to be writers, which is different.
Yes. Right? Well, let's talk about this because you alluded to me before the tape was rolling, that there's a considerable amount of fiction that you're sitting on or that was rejected. You mentioned this Publisher's Weekly interview that you did where editors basically said, "You're a bad mother." And
yes, I've had that said to me, to my face.
To your face?
Yes, at
really?
KGB.
KGB?
Yeah, at an Open City reading.
Wow.
Yeah.
What? Just go up. They went, she just was patiently waiting for you to finish reading?
No, it was a man. I didn't read. I was attending a reading.
Oh, and they just saw you and said, "You're a bad, not even a hi, how do you do?"
Well, it was funny. I was being introduced to him by another editor.
Yeah.
And they were kind of looking at each other. And it was about the story Baby.
Yeah.
Which he at first accepted and then 3 months later rejected. And then I'm meeting him at this party. And the other editor, they're looking at each other. And then she says, "He thinks you're a bad mother." And I said, "Really?"
Wait, no, he didn't actually say this to you. The editor said, "He thinks you're a bad mother."
And he
they
was
couldn't
worried.
Actually go ahead and say to
yeah,
you,
he was
"You're
sitting
a bad
there,
mother."
No,
like,
no.
Yeah, okay,
so
yeah.
I guess he didn't say it.
Okay.
But he said it to her.
The ultimate
and he was
passive
sitting
aggression.
There. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing, it was one of those really ugly moments.
Wow.
That don't happen too often. Well, with my work, actually, I've had a few people, you know, it's not for everybody. And another time, an agent, I actually cried about this, an agent wrote me a really, just like, "This is so offensive." Like, you're obviously, you know, and satire is supposed to be a little offensive, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, so maybe she's just a dumb agent. I don't know, but it does hurt. I've gotten tougher because I'm 42 and I have been writing since college, and I got my graduate degree at City College in my mid-20s. So I'm tougher than I was.
When were these rejections? Was this about 10 years ago, 5 years ago?
I think the novel, the woman who I offended was about 5 years ago.
Okay.
So I go through phases of, you know, trying to send things out. I also have a very quiet book that's very different, which is, that's, you know, it's really fun for me. And there's some quiet stories in here. I would call the second son of a quiet story. So they're not all about causing trouble.
Yeah.
And I, yeah, so.
Well, I mean,
I am sitting on some other manuscripts, definitely.
That's true. But you mentioned earlier about how, oh, I'm older and I'm quieter. And we were talking about this issue earlier of whether their characters are wrong, whether the perspective is wrong.
Right.
I mean, you know, on some level, you have to write true to your voice. And hey, look, this book was published. I'm talking with you here right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, at what point does whether you are offending someone, to what degree does it matter even?
It shouldn't. And it used to bother me more. But I also feel like if I'm really, really offending someone, then, you know, the self-doubt, which I think all writers suffer, you know, oh, I didn't do what I wanted to do here. I am being misunderstood because I'm trying to have fun by having my characters think and do the wrong things. And also people do think and do the wrong things all the time. You know, you just watch Law and Order.
Watch the world around you.
Yeah, go outside, which I try not to do. No, I'm just kidding. So a lot, you know, I could be defensive and say that when my work offends somebody, I've touched a nerve. And that people have said that to me. It's like, you're touching a nerve. Obviously, there's something that's, you know, inside of them that they're uncomfortable feeling. And then I think that's not necessarily a bad thing, making people uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. That's or to do in fiction. In real life, I don't, you know, like I'm very different.
Have you consciously tried to write for the market to try to sort of dilute it so that people would not be offended, that they wouldn't have their nerve touched, so to speak?
Well, the quieter book that I wrote was an exercise in trying not to go to those uncomfortable places. But as I said in the Publishers Weekly interview, like I like being brave, and to me, uncomfortable and brave are connected in my work.
Yeah.
In real life, like I don't even ski anymore. Like I'm not brave at all.
I once talked to Scott Smith, who of course did The Ruins, which was an absolutely grotesque, wonderfully grotesque novel.
Oh, I
didn't. And it's just about plants eating people and the like.
Okay.
Sweetest guy in the world, you know,
right?
Very,
yeah.
Very mellow. The horror writers in general tend to be really nice people.
I know, really?
Yeah,
isn't that funny?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I know. So there's not always that Patricia Highsmith connection.
Not always.
Although I would argue that she's very compassionate to her murders.
Oh, certainly.
And
in
that's
her work,
part, that's why her work is so powerful.
Yeah.
But, I'm sorry. So what was the...
Well, no, I just was kind of interjecting, but maybe this bravery or this courage is possibly related to a sense of fun. It has to be fun for you.
It is. Yeah. And sometimes it's actually painful. Mm-hmm. Like Baby was... That was a fun story. Not all, The Second Son was an incredibly painful story to write and is probably most autobiographical. And sometimes... Yeah, and so that one, it was, I was talking to someone, it was every morning I would wake up and just dread working on that story because it hurt, but I also felt like it needed to be done. So that's an experience that I sometimes have. Not always.
Yeah.
You know, everything is kind of different. The only similar thing in my writing process is that I usually have no idea where I'm going.
Yeah.
That's kind of a general rule.
Do you distrust the writing if you don't feel this real crushing sense of emotion? Or?
Well, like I said, I did write a kind of a quieter book that's it's almost muted. Generally speaking, I want to be taking emotional risks because that's the kind of fiction I enjoy reading. So that's, you know, what I try to write. That's where I try to go with my fiction. I don't know if it's something that I will always be doing. I definitely think that writing that really kind of muted book was fun. And then my latest project, you know, that I'm kind of, I have an outline for is more Patricia Highsmith-y, involves like murder. Like I want to write something with a murder, you know?
Yeah.
So, I don't want to always be writing a domestic fiction, but when I was doing it, I think a lot of heart into the two manuscripts, and it's not something that, and it's possibly something I'll explore again.
Have you read Iris Owens's After Claude?
No,
you
have not.
You should totally read that. It's exactly the kind of thing that you're doing to... I mean, she does it differently, obviously, but it's wonderfully vicious and very uncomfortable and very funny, but also very true to the New York of the 1970s.
And
it just was put out by the New York Review of Books.
I love what they do. They do wonderful things. They published or reprinted or whatever, that Peter Handke book, Sorrow Beyond Dreams, which I wrote an essay about. They do great stuff. But, I read very little contemporary fiction, which surprises some people. I think I read Wells Towers' collection, which I like, and I read Mary Gateskill's collection. And then otherwise, I read this... English spent my whole summer reading this huge four-book series called The Cazalet Chronicles by Elizabeth Jane Howard. Mm-hmm. And she has the most brutal birth scene in and just this mother is completely out of her depths. No one's heard of her. And she's just fantastic and wildly brave. I wouldn't say no one's heard of her, but she's not here. She's not, I don't think she's really not in print. I had to buy some of her out-of-print stuff. Sometimes I have a fear of reading contemporary writers in that it was going to mess with my with what I'm writing, which is maybe a superstition, and it's not always true. Alicia Orion, I read The Brutal Language of Love, and that was a moment, or Mary Gateskill, where I'm like, wow, I really want to do that. This is what I want to do. I want to try to do something like this. Yeah. But otherwise, I sit around like reading Tolstoy. Which actually, these stories, there's the quote at the beginning of the book. Did you see the from the Kreutzer Sonata?
Yes.
Okay. And then basically, I read the Kreutzer Sonata and Family Happiness about 8 or 10 years ago, and kind of reread them and took some notes. And a lot of these stories are in a response, not a revising, but a response to those two stories in that he deals with class and the tragedy of social ambition. And then he also deals with sexual problems between married couples, jealousy, despair. And it all is in Russia a long time ago, but it's all here too. You know, it's just really...
Yeah, you're saying that the sexual problems in these stories, I actually want to talk about them specifically. The frustrated sexuality by men are in response to these to Tolstoy, basically.
Well, I mean, all of this... Yeah, the stories are in terms of dealing with the class and also the sexual frustration. I guess a lot of my characters are sexually frustrated.
Well, I mean, there's a peculiar kind... I want to cite specific examples so people know what the hell we're talking about.
Okay.
The mother of his children, you have Ted Stanton, and he's fantasizing about fucking Larry Worth up the ass. Larry Worth is the president of the company at the place he works. You have Superstition, which begins with George's expressing his favorite way to fuck his wife, which is up the ass, or from behind specifically. And then it ends on the note of a blowjob. And then, Peter finding it sexy to be beaten by Karen at pool in the shitty handshake, which I found quite funny. Now, and then, of course, I could always mention the fact that in Baby, the baby's ears are described like vaginas. There seems to be a very interesting perversion at work here, that the sexual tastes by men that are, sometimes they're almost closeted to a certain degree. I mean, Kinsey, if he had read your collection, probably would have had a field day with this. How did this develop? It's both funny, but it's also very alarming because the failure to address their true sexuality and their honest sexuality often results in very disturbing action at times. And so, but yeah, on the other hand, when the thoughts are contained in their head, as I suggested earlier, it is there's a lot of comic tension there.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. I don't really. Again, it's interesting to hear people read my work. I didn't mean to have them sexually repressed, homosexual kind of a thing, but there's definitely sexual unhappiness, and some confusion and shame, but isn't that kind of like part of life?
Absolutely.
And especially I mean, this has kind of been written about in very blasé terms and probably Fit Pregnancy magazine, but getting pregnant and having small children changes people's sex life, at least temporarily.
Yeah.
I don't think permanently, but I remember after my second son was born, and months had gone by, and, you know, we're just, like, completely exhausted and going to bed at 8:30. And at one point, my husband walked up to me, and he put his hands on my shoulders, and he goes, "I miss you." But we hadn't gone anywhere. Like, I hadn't gone anywhere. Yeah. You just, you don't really have time for each other. Yeah. So I wanted to kind of explore that when you do it internally in their heads, it's not just like, oh, they're not having sex. It's like, and this is what it's causing them to feel, because that sex is important. It's, sure, a, you know, money's important. Sex is important. Like, you know, it's one of the important things in life.